So first of all, I just wanted to dedicate this year as Memorial Day to all those, obviously, who gave their lives in service to this country. And we should never take what they do for granted. And truth of the matter is that maybe we live in a part of the country where this isn't felt as acutely in some other parts of the country. But we all benefit from those who put themselves in harm's way to defend our way of life, even with all of the terrible things that we experience this year in Pittsburgh and in Poway, outside of San Diego. The fact that those things are so rare is itself, right, a reminder of what a blessing this country is for us. Unfortunately, throughout most of Jewish history, that would not have been in any way exceptional, even if it would still be, of course, tragic, and we have to be so grateful for this wonderful and country, which is such a blessing to us. And it doesn't happen by itself. It happens because people are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice. And so it would be only appropriate for us to learn with those who gave their lives for us in mind. And as we wrap up, and again, not the series, as Daniel pointed out, but just this particular season, resume right in, I guess, in the context of Labor Day. We'll have to be in touch. I'll have to look at how, the calendar falls, maybe even a little bit before, so I'll have to see. The truth is that Sefer Shmuel, we called it of priests, prophets, and kings, is in many ways very confounding kind of a work, where we begin with this figure, Eli, and we see how things fall apart for him. And then we see the rise of Shmuel, and how Shmuel is able to do his job just about the best way it could be done, bringing justice to the people, not just giving them access to judgment. But you remember the concept of the circuit court, which is used in very recent times. And then the fact that his children are certainly not following in his footsteps, either literally or figuratively. And that brings about the monarchy. And then we see the rise of Shaul, the third major figure in our Sefer, and we're very much in the process of his undoing and his unwinding. And so there's kind of like a roller coaster effect to learning Sefer Shmuel. So you have people who rise up and then they come crashing down with, and we talk about people, crashing down. We don't mean with a little gentle landing, right? Eli gets a curse on his household, which is unprecedented in all of Tanakh. We're watching Shaul's active disintegration here. So that's something to think about just in terms of the arc of the Sefer. Point number one. Point number two, just to briefly review what we saw last week, is Shaul tries not once, not twice, but three times to kill David. First himself, remember the spear. And after he's not able to do that, because David keeps on jumping out of the way, remember, he thinks to himself, okay, I'm going to pretend to David that I'm giving him my daughter in marriage, but really it's just a ruse because I'm going to send him out to the front and he's going to be killed by the Plishtim in his zeal, not so much to become the king's son-in-law, because remember, David was very reticent about that, but because, the Plishtim are the enemies of the Jewish people and that by extension the enemies of God. Today we have a whole vocabulary that surrounds these things. A person survived, three attempts on his life. We could talk about a person being traumatized and PTSD. And sometimes we don't even, internalize for ourselves what David was going through. Remember, David has basically been brought from his family, into this person's home. And he's experiencing, let's put it mildly, somewhat abusive conditions. I think that's a fair term to apply. A situation where your boss is trying to kill you, literally, on more than one occasion. And, somehow he has to deal with this. And he doesn't have parental guidance. And even Shmuel, the one who anointed him, right? It's not like Shmuel is coming and putting his arm around his shoulder and saying, it's okay, David, it comes with the territory. Everybody who I anoint, they just have to jump out of the way of spears. It's all part of the, growth experience. You just have to deal with it. And sometimes I think about that. I just find myself thinking about the Sefer all week and think about, without imposing too many of my own personal modern categories onto David HaMelech, but what, it just had to have been a very harrowing experience. And So a very lonely experience. Now, a little bit of that loneliness we saw chipped away at last week. Because remember, Yonatan, who's the crown prince, and in a certain sense, the one who has the most to be concerned about with respect to David, even more than his father, right? His father's the king. But Yonatan, right, forms this covenant with David, this very intense bond. And we can all appreciate how much that must have meant to David, who otherwise is completely isolated. And we can only but respect Yonatan for not putting his own personal interest in front of the national interest. And even though Yonatan himself, as we discussed earlier in Shmuel, great courage. Remember when he went up with his Nosei Kelim to attack the Plishti garrison, and he was able to bring a great victory to the Plishti. But even Yonatan, who's a great warrior and is clearly able to inspire the people. Remember, Shaul was going to kill him, but the people say, you know, Yonatan Yamut, Asher Asah, Chuad, Golaz, Obi Israel. So Yonatan, in all of his characteristics, is still able to say, wait a second, you know, I may have some things going for me, but David is, he's different. There's something different about him. And that is to his great credit. It's not easy to say that, especially for somebody, you know, who is talented and who is capable in the way that he is. And so, you know, that's a little bit of a balm or a salve to David insofar as his isolation is concerned. So this last chapter of the season I titled Closing In, and I hope that you'll see over the course of the next half hour or so how it's a double entendre. I have two different characters in mind. I talk about this image of things closing in on them. Vayidaber Shaul, Yonatan beno velko avadav lehamid et David, v'yonatan ben Shaul chafetz b'David ma'od. So Shaul, after the three failed attempts of chapter 18 to kill David, gives a formal instruction to Yonatan and to his inner circle, close cadre of advisors, for David's life, to kill David. And the Navi again comments, parenthetically, that Yonatan loved David very much. So Yonatan tells David that Shaul, my father, is out to kill you. Something that David knew, but Yonatan may not have known because he wasn't in the room when the spear was being thrown. I can't prove this, but it's my very strong suspicion that David didn't tell anybody about what had happened. Rightly convinced that until this moment, right, Yonatan didn't know this because we see him acting on it. So if he knew this before, probably would have shared the information before. So sometimes that itself can be an indication. You see somebody reacting immediately to something, that may be an indication that they didn't quite know it before. So this strikes me as news to Yonatan, even though from our point of view, maybe old news, because you know we've been privy to the text, and been privy to moments that only David and Shaul would have known about, very private moments, and even Shaul's plan to have David killed by sending him out in that quest for the dowry. It's not like Shaul articulated that to anybody. The Navi gives us an insight into what's going on in Shaul's mind. So it would appear, okay, that Yonatan is first recognizing something that David surely knows by now. Okay, so this is like one of these situations in life. You have to kind of put yourself there, right? The person that's telling you the information thinks that it's new information to you. So you're always left with a choice. What's the choice? You tell them that you knew, or you go along with it. In this case, what would it mean for David to tell Yonatan that he knows that? What would he then have to say? Kind of, right? You'd have to sort of say, yeah, I know that. Your father's been throwing spears at me. And I don't think David wants to do that.
No. You might confuse me. We've had the Machachorish scene yet?
Not yet. No. Not yet. No. That has not yet happened. We're going to have like a proto Machachorish scene. So...
What's a
Machachorish? Oh. Nothing actually. Nothing actually. It's just a scene that's going to be coming up in the text where Yonatan says to David, you gotta go. You can't stay here anymore. It's just too dangerous. So we're going to have like a pre-Machar Chodesh, what it means tomorrow's Rosh Chodesh. It's the Haftorah that we always read, Erev Rosh Chodesh. So Dr. Gertler is using a little jargon for the Tzitzit. That's it. That's okay. Hey, that's okay. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So, So, you know, to tell Shaul that, yeah, I know your father's trying to kill me, would be to divulge that his father has been behaving in this erratic and, you know, emotionally disturbed way.
Is he ignorant of the Ruach
Ra'ah? He surely knows about that, because he knows why David was hired, but he doesn't know that his father is, lashing out and trying to kill people. That's a whole different level. So I think we can, you know, as we go on in this conversation, have a great deal of respect for David's discretion. First of all, his respect for majesty, which is something that's been well established, but also his respect for Yonatan's relationship with his father. And sometimes you don't share everything because it's painful. And painful for a son in a way that it might not be for another person. So I think David has a dual motivation, but he should be credited. And I just keep that thought in mind, because it's going to be one of the concluding observations that we make. So Vani Eitzei, so Yonatan says to David, V'amati li'ad avi basadeh asher atah sham, V'ani adaber b'cha l'avi, v'ra'iti ma v'igati lach. So Yonatan says to David, he says, I want to sort of test out how serious my father is about harming you, how committed he is to harming you. So we're going to have a conversation in the field, and then I'm going to report back to you. And David, again, just does not react, even though much of this information is surely not new to him. Vayidaber Yonatan b'David tov el Shaul aviv, vayomer elav, ayechta hamelech be'avdo b'David, ki lo chatalach, v'chi masav tov l'cha me'od. Vayasem enafsho v'chapo, vayachar aplishti, vayas Adonai tshua gdola l'chol Yisrael, ra'ita v'tismach, v'lama techta b'dam naki l'amida David chinam. So Yonatan says to Shaul, Dad, why are you going after David? First of all, he hasn't done anything against you, but on the contrary, he's been, most loyal to you. And he created a great salvation of the Jewish people when he killed Goliath. So why would you want to shed innocent blood? And Shaul recognizes, and he has one of these moments of clarity, Vayishma Shaul v'kol Yonatan, Vayishava Shaul, Chai Adonai in Yuman, and he takes the ultimate oath, the Shavua B'Shem Hashem, which is a very significant level of oath. He says, you're right, I absolutely will not kill him. So again, this is part of the reason that my particular reading, what I find most compelling, is to see Shaul as somebody who's struggling with an emotional disturbance, with a kind of a mental illness. And there are moments where, we might call them colloquially good days and bad days. And it comes about pretty suddenly, those changes. So this is a moment where Shaul is perfectly receptive to reason and says, there's no basis to harm David, and his son is pointing this out. And not only does he say, I'm not going to harm him, but he takes an oath. And not just an oath, but an oath in the name of God, which is as committed as you could possibly be. Remember, then in Halacha, somebody's being accused in a monetary case of having some outstanding debt. The way to speak, clear your name and to absolve yourself from otherwise having to pay is to take an oath, right? It's not a small matter. The Torah basically operates on the assumption that people are not going to take false oaths, that, even people who might be prepared to otherwise do wrong will simply be unprepared to take an oath and desecrate God's name. Vayikra Yonatan David, so Yonatan, this is why I call it Dr. Gertler, proto-machar chodesh, right? It's in the field trying to figure out what the story is, but here, all the arrows, pardon the pun, are pointing in the right direction, right? It looks like it's okay. So Yonatan reports back as such, Vayaged lo Yonatan et kol advarim ha'ela, Vayave Yonatan et David el Shaul, and Yonatan actually physically brings David back, Vayhi lefanav ket mol shel shom. And it was like nothing ever happened. Daniel. Yes.
And so in according to is Yonatan a more of a malchus in that case?
In a sense that he's trying to convince his father that
the will of a king.
Right. It's a very good question. It would seem to me that the answer is no, on the basis that the Rambam defines a Morid B'Malchus as somebody who's violating the will of the king, but only on the condition that the will of the king is not in violation of the Torah. So if the king says, you know, everybody's got to eat broccoli, and this guy says, you know, no way, cauliflower for me, that's Morid B'Malchus. So the king says, you know, we're going to kill this innocent guy, and somebody says, no, I'm not doing that. That would not be Morid B'Malchus. So it seems to me that Yonatan would have the defense here of, like, you know, this would be murder. Yeah. Okay, so, right, Vatosav HaMilchama Liot, so this ongoing, you know, it's not a battle, it's this, you know, struggle between the Jews and the Philistines. Vatosav HaMilchama Liot, Vayitze David Vayelachem V'Paplishtim, Vayach Bahem Makah Gedola, Vayanusu Mipanav. So again, David strikes a major blow against the Plishtim, and they all flee, literally Mipanav, from David. So you see, David now has, just to put it in perspective, this is exactly the expression that the text used about how the Jews reacted to Goliath. But they literally, Vayanusu Mipanav, they ran away from him. They were just scared out of their minds. So now the Plishtim are having this exact reaction to David. That's how, you know, the intimidation factor of David has grown. Shaul balafav, v'David b'rivavotav. Vati ruach Adonai ra'al Shaul v'hu b'veito yoshev v'chanito b'yado v'David m'agen b'yad v'yivakesh Shaul l'akot b'chanit b'David u'bakir v'yiftar m'bnei Shaul v'yachad achanit b'akir v'David nas v'yimaleit b'laylahu. So right after this skirmish, this battle, that seems like that very next day, David is playing the harp again for Shaul, and it would seem like there's some causal relationship. All of a sudden, Shaul has one of these bouts of, you know, rage against David. Hard to see it as unrelated to the fact that David again is achieving military success. And what does he do? He picks up the spear. This is now time number three. And he throws it with such velocity that it literally sticks into the wall, right? It penetrates the wall, goes in. That's how it's able to stick in the wall. And David flees for his life. So here you have this, you know, very clear literary contrast where the Plishtim are run away from David, and David is in the, you know, meanwhile running for his own life, right? Because Shaul, who he's not going to defend himself by, you know, trying to kill Shaul, who is Mashiach Hashem, the anointed one of God, so David is running for his life. Vayishlach Shaul malachim al beit David l'shamro, u'amito baboker, v'tagei l'David michal ishto le'mor, imincha memaleit et nafshecha halayla, machar atamumad. So that very night, Shaul sends soldiers to guard the door to David's house so he can't escape, and the idea is they're going to kill him in the morning, and Michal says to David, it's now or never. You either run away now or, you know, you're a dead man. My father's going to kill you. V'atavad Michal at David ba'at ha'chalon, v'ayilech v'ayivrach v'ayimaleit. So we have this image of Michal letting David down out of the window, some kind of a rope, right? Out of some kind of a second-story window, and David runs away. And this, of course, is reminiscent of the only other image we have in Tanakh of that, which is Rahab, when they first crossed the land of Israel. And you have these two spies who are running away from the king of Jericho, who is trying to kill them. And here we have this kind of this tragic moment, when we think about it, where, you know, we have now a sovereign Jewish king, and yet David HaMelech has to run like the Meraglim ran for their lives in Jericho before we had any Jewish presence in the land of Israel, before we had any Jewish state, so to speak, in the land of Israel, and yet this is still going on. So, you know, this takes you back in so many ways to the image of Rachab, but also gets you thinking about the ways, you know, that progress has been made since the days of Rachab, but there's also a lot that hasn't been established, because clearly, if David has to be lowered down a window and run for his life from the king, right, then there's some unfinished work, to put it mildly. Dr. Gertler.
Now Shaul has two offspring that have chosen to
here we go. So that's exactly the idea, and that's part of what I meant by closing in. So that's one, you know, one piece of it is that for Shaul, things are closing in on him, right? His own family, right, is now actively conspiring against him. Yonatan and Michal are both siding with David. But I want you to just to keep in mind maybe an openness to kind of a contrast between Yonatan and Michal in the ensuing psukim. Because you're absolutely right. Both of them are not prepared to go along with their father's idea of killing David. They both are described as loving David very much. But I still see a major difference in the way that they relate to their father. So let's take a quick look at that. V'tikach Michal et ha-trafim, v'tasem el hamita, v'et kivir ha'izim samem rashotav, v'techas babaged, v'yishlach shol malachim akachar et David v'tomer cholehu, v'yishlach shol et malachim l'rod et David le'mor, halu oto v'mita ilai l'mito. So here's the scene. David, of course, is, you know, running as fast as he can to get away, and Michal stuffs the bed with trafim, which the Ibn Ezra defines in Sefer Bereishis as something that kind of looked like a human being, and for hair, she takes some goat skin, okay? And meanwhile, Shaul sends the soldiers into the house, and Michal says, look, he's sick, and like the question is what to do. Kind of that looks like a human form in the bed. And Shaul says, well, bring him in bed. I'm going to kill him, you know, in bed, basically. So, trafim come up, of course, for the first time in which context? Rachel deceiving her father. So, right, the image of, and this, of course, is Shaul from Binyamin, son of Rachel. So the image of trafim, the daughter deceives the father. Interesting. And what about the Seir Izim? Seir Izim is used by Rivka Yaakov to deceive Yitzchak. So we brought out all the deceptive elements. We're putting them together. You know, put a little bit of, you know, paprika, you know, and you have the deception Torah mix here. Okay. So Michal is choosing the path of deception. Right? She's subverting her father, but she's using the path of deception. Now, Yonatan was, right, not going to go along with his father's plot to kill David, but what was his approach? Confrontation, right? Again, not confrontation in the violent sense, but saying, you know, father, right, in a nice and respectful way, but basically, you know, how can you do this? So this is a very different kind of approach. And Michal's approach is, right, without any question, a much more complicated approach to take, because once you start going down the path of deception, so then, you know, whose side are you on, really? Just one second, I just want to get one more pasuk in, because this really brings the idea home. So, Vayomer Shaul, Vayavo HaMalachim, so when the soldiers break into the house, Yuneha Trafim Alamitag, Fira Yisim Yerashatav, they discover that wasn't David. The bed was stuffed with, you know, Trafim. Vayomer Shaul Michal, Lama Kacha Rimitani, right? Rimitini, why did you do this to me? Vatshashalchi Etoivi Vayimalait, right? And you let David run away. Vatomer Michal El Shaul, so she says to him, Hu Aymari Lai Shalcheni, Lama mitech. So Michal says to her father, I had no choice because David threatened me. He says, if I don't let him go out of the window, then he's going to come and kill me, and I was afraid. So what does she end up doing here? She ends up presenting David as somebody who is prepared to kill the princess, Shaul's daughter. So she ends up incriminating him in a very serious way. So you know, we should be balanced about this, right? She did save David's life, okay? That's number one. But at the same time, you can't really say that she's exactly doing what Yonatan is doing, right? Because
she's not prepared to let her father know.
Right, and she seems to be a little bit more divided about the whole thing. She's gonna subvert what her father was doing, but she's not prepared to, you know, openly side with David. And this, of course, is foreshadowing many things to come about the complexity where Michal always feels a certain sense of loyalty to her father and her father's kingdom. And that's something that does not elude David's attention. He knows very well where she stands on this issue. So Michal and Yonatan, there are certain parallels, but I think the Navi is also trying to make it clear that they didn't exactly handle it in the same way. And to present David as somebody who was about to kill his own wife, the princess, the daughter of the king, that is an indictment of him. And even if it was a lie that she felt she needed to tell in the moment, we should be very clear that she's now presented David to her father, who doesn't seem to need very much encouragement, right? But she's presenting David to her father in a way that really seems like somebody who deserves to be treated this way. If somebody was trying to kill your daughter, God forbid, right, you'd be very violent. If somebody was prepared to kill his own wife, even if it wasn't your daughter, you'd think that this person was a monster. So she saved him, but in a certain sense, she's also, you know, irrevocably set her father against David forever. So this is a complicated thing that Michal has done. Yes. But why couldn't Michal have done the same thing? That's what I'm not following.
Is she going to say why? In other words, she actively helped him. So far, we
No, no, I understand. But why can't she, before she actively helps him, why can't she go marching up to the soldiers or marching to her father and say, this man has done nothing? I don't know that that's entirely fair. Look at Esther.
Esther
manipulated. But she's very direct. She had to establish a context for it, but I don't see Michal as a weak character. She had to lay the groundwork for it. I don't question that, but I'm not sure that I agree with you that women by definition are powerless, or that women are with. I think that Michal behaves that way, but I don't know that she... I think that deprives her of choice, which I don't know that we should. I think that she's choosing to behave a certain way. And again, it seems to me that as the story unfolds, and maybe it's a little bit unfair of me to retroject it into the text, but I think that Michal had a lot of ambivalence about this. I think that she felt genuinely torn, you know, between her husband and her father. And the scene that I'll, of course, I'm alluding to is when she looks right out of the window. Remember, the window is a significant part. And she sees David dancing with the Aron, and she goes nuts. And she says, Man nichbad hayom melech Yisrael, you know, basically you're degrading the institution of majesty because, you know, you're not officious like my father was. And David says to her, Hashem asher b'char bi mikol beit avich, right? Let's put our cards on the table. So I guess I see that Michal has more power than she... I guess that's where we're diverging here. And I would say that it's just evidence of somebody who's ambivalent. The very fact that she said... You know, she could have said that, well, I didn't know that you were trying to kill David. Right? It's not like she was part of that meeting. Right?
But she didn't know.
How did she know? No, I'm saying she didn't. She could have said to her father, you're trying to kill David? No, you would never do that. He's so innocent. He keeps on helping you. He's your best general. There are these rogue soldiers outside that were trying to kill him. Of course I let him go. She wasn't part of that meeting where he said, let's go kill David. It's supposed to be a big secret. What's that? Right. So I'm saying, I think she had options. And the fact that she chose to portray David as somebody who was prepared to kill her is not... She did him a favor by saving his life, but she also didn't do him such a big favor. This is a more complicated act. And I don't see her as particularly innocent. What's that?
She should have come up with a better story.
Well, I think at minimum, but I don't know that she needed to do any of this, right? I think she either could have been very direct about the whole thing, or if she was going to go the deceptive route, she could have said to her father, you'll never believe it, there are these guys here that are saying that they want to kill David. Like, why would you let them kill your son-in-law? He's done nothing but good for you. The same way that Yonatan said so 5 minutes ago. So I think Michal is just very ambivalent about the whole situation. Yeah, Eva.
I think she's just a very weak character. But I do agree that there is a certain amount of career
So you're saying that at this point, you know, she relates to her father as somebody who's, you know, totally unpredictable, emotionally unstable. Yeah, that I could see, though it would be, you know, if that were indeed the case, it would be, you know, particularly indiscreet of her to tell her father that her husband was trying to kill her, right? And so I think I really agree with that formulation. I do detect a certain kind of weakness here, or I guess what I called like an ambivalence, where she can't really decide what to do, and she ends up doing something that doesn't serve David's long-term interests well, and that'll be a big part of the story. So David's running. So the question, you know, the big question when somebody's running is obviously where to go. Yeah, that's always the question, you know. It's a great story in my family. My great-grandfather on my mom's side, literally, speaking of jumping out the window, during the Civil War in Russia, the aftermath of the First World War, between what were called the Whites and the Reds, it wasn't clear, you know, what the Jews should do. But in 1918, they came to draft him into the White Army, into the Tsarist Army, which was not like, good from an actuarial standpoint for your longevity or anything else. So he literally jumped out of the window and didn't stop running till he came to the United States of America. So my dad first came into the family, my mom, this is my mom's grandfather, my dad was, still is into exercising, into running in particular, and he said, "Zadie, I'm going running." So my grandfather said, "Your grandfather's 88, he said, "From who?" You know, like, why would you be doing that, right? So running, so the question is, where, you know, what are you going to do? So in David's case, there wasn't an obvious answer, unfortunately. Because we've noted that home was not such a safe place for him. And there's all this mistrust of him at home. And Shaul's home is no longer safe from him. So if you're David, where would you go exactly? So soon we're going to see that David actually goes out into the Midbar. But we're not there yet. So who's he going to go to? Can't go to his own father. Not to Shaul. So Yonatan, right, there's a geographic problem. Definitely if Yonatan had his own province somewhere, that would have been the idea. So he doesn't have anywhere to go. So he goes back to Shmuel. He's the last person Shmuel anointed him. So anyway, ודוד ברח מימלא ויבוא שמואל הרמטה, ויגלו את כל אשר עשה לו שאול, וילכו שמואל, וישבו בניות. So Shmuel and David basically sit. ויגד לשאול, אמור הנה דוד בניות ברמה. Shaul hears, right, that David went running to Shmuel. And so Shaul sends three delegations. וישלח שאול מלאכים לקחת את דוד, וירד להקר הנביאים ניבים, ושמואל עומד ניצב עליהם, ועתי על מלאכי שאול, רוח אלוהים, וינבו גם המה. ויגידו לשאול, וישלח מלאכים אחרים, וינבו גם המה. ויוסף שאול, וישלח מלאכים שלישים, וינבו גם המה. The same story. He sends the first group, the second group, the third group, to go and bring David, drag him back, and kill him. And each time they're overtaken by the spirit of prophecy, once they enter into Shmuel's presence, where Shmuel is kind of with these B'nai HaNevi'im, these prophets in training, if you will. Vayilach kamhu aramata. So Shaul says, that's it. Taking care of it myself. Vayavo ad bor agadol asher basechu. Basher basachu, excuse me. Vayishal vayomer ifo Shmuel v'David. He's asking around, where are these guys? Vayomer hine b'nayot barama. So somebody points him in the direction. Vayilach sham al nayot barama. Vati alav gamhu ruach Elohim. Vayilach haloch vayitnabei ad bo'o b'nayot barama. So Shaul is overtaken by the spirit of prophecy himself, right? He's no longer obviously in a position to kill David. Vayivshat gamhu begadav, and he literally takes off his clothes. So Rashi and various Mefarshim say it's just he took off his royal garments, but literal reading is that he literally undressed, almost like images of King Lear. Always wondered if Shakespeare had taken the image from here. We'll need to ask some Shakespeare scholars if indeed, Shakespeare was familiar enough with Shmuel to have made the image, but certainly the most famous image of King Lear is this exact image of him fully, in the nude. Vayinabe gam hu lifnei Shmuel, vayipol arom, naked. Kol yom ahu v'chol alayla. Al ken yomru hagam Shaul b'nevi'im. And at that time they said, is Shaul amongst the prophets? You remember that that's not the first time we had that expression. Remember at the very beginning, when Shaul was first anointed by Shmuel, and Shmuel says, we're going to have all these encounters, and people are going to say, Hagam Shaul b'nevi'im. But now we've come full circle. And unfortunately, instead of being on the ascent, right, this is clearly an image of Shaul, who's come to shed blood, and he's intercepted by the prophetic root. And instead of having the Ruach Hashem in the positive sense, he's now afflicted in a terrible way by the Ruach Hashem Ra'ah. And that's where the chapter concludes. So I mentioned at the beginning that I called it closing in. I meant it in two senses. So first of all, you know, Shaul's world is closing in on itself, right? Where Shaul's closest people, his family, his children, right, are acting in different ways to subvert his, paranoid, intentions and behaviors. And his world is really collapsing and closing in on itself. But then in a very literal sense, David's world is closing in also. Where David, has to literally be worried about survival. And for that, he can't go home, and he's ejected from his own house, from Michal, and he's searching for a place, and he ends up running back to Shmuel. So the world is kind of closing in on David, even as it's closing in at the same time, but in a different way on Shaul, and that's striking to me. I guess the final point I would make is something, not that happens in this chapter, but anybody notice something that didn't happen once in this chapter, even though, of course, the chapter in so many ways is about David? What does David not do? Exactly. There's not a single word that we're told that came out of his mouth from the very beginning. So from, Yonatan saying to David, my father's trying to kill you, doesn't answer, say anything. Michal telling David very much the same. Shaul throwing the spear at him. The closest you get to any dialogue whatsoever is the narrator reporting that David told Shaul what happened, but doesn't give him a voice. It actually deliberately takes away whatever words that he might have said to Shmuel, right? Which would have been really interesting. I think that would have been a fascinating perspective to hear, is David's voice. Like, I would have loved to hear David saying, like, you're not going to believe what's happening, but this is, like, I actually just came from the window. And before that, there is this spear, and that actually happened 3 times. And, since, you last anointed me, I killed a giant and won some major military victories for the Jewish people, but this doesn't seem to be helping me. Like, that would have been a really interesting conversation to hear, and his voice is totally taken away. So, this image that we have of David, who on the one hand is certainly the Jewish future, right? He's the anointed one. But, we shouldn't underestimate, the path to getting there and how arduous and complex it must have been, where David is literally portrayed here as an object. He's not even given a voice, and he's just, trying to survive. And Yonatan is speaking, and Michal is speaking, and Shaul is speaking, and the Nevi'im.
And David's king.
And David is, he's not king yet. He's anointed, but he's not king. He's not king. He's very careful about that. Very respectful. Very respectful about that. He's anointed, but he's not king yet. And he won't be king for a very long time. And his respect for that is really remarkable. We saw a little bit of that today. We talked about how he wasn't willing to, tell Yonatan, I know your father's trying to kill me. He keeps on trying to kill me. That's how I know. Actually kill me with his own spear. So David is exceptionally respectful of the fact that Shaul is the king, and until Shaul is no longer the king, David...
What do you need besides being anointed?
You need the current king not to be the king anymore.
You need him to step down?
Well, abdication would be one possibility, but that doesn't seem like it's in the cards, right? Shaul doesn't seem like he's contemplating abdication. So quite the contrary, right? So David is enormously respectful of that. And that's sort of where we'll leave things off with David as such an object in this story that he's not even given a voice. He's just literally running for his life And the only place that he has left to go is back to Shmuel. As you can imagine, he's not going to be able to stay there very long, both for his sake and for Shmuel's sake. And where we'll pick it up, God willing, you know, around September time, is right here, is, you know, with Shaul in full pursuit at this point, and with David as the pursued. And for the rest of all of Shmuel Aleph, that dynamic is not going to change. And well into Shmuel Bet, David is not going to be in a position to be the king. And so, just again, you know, we think about David as David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. We know the end of the story, but it's important for us to keep in mind that David had to live through it in the present. And the harrowing nature of this experience, and literally, you know, having to run for your life in the kind of way that he did. Again, it wasn't like, you know, he had one near-death experience. This happened again and again and again and again. And how that sort of shaped David, I think, is really critical, because you're talking about a person who we observed when we first met him is very sensitive to the honor of God. And he's very close to God and is very upset about that being violated in any way. And just imagine that proclivity. And sometimes you have a person with a proclivity for whom life experience will reinforce that. And David's life experience teaches him that, like, he's got nobody to rely on. He's literally on his own, and the one person, being, that he can turn to is God. And, you know, if you've just, even in a very cursory manner, read Sefer Tehillim, that's exactly the impression that you get. Ki avivi miyazavuni v'Hashem yasfeini. And dozens and hundreds of psukim along those lines. Ki v'cha Hashem chasisi, I take refuge in Hashem ma'uzi, miskabi, God is my only source of strength. And so that's coming from somewhere. It's certainly coming from a disposition or a proclivity. It's also coming from an experience of running for your life and not having anywhere to go. And having the people that, you know, you thought, you know, were closest to you. Shaul took him in as a kind of a surrogate son. And, you know, we're witnessing what happened. So the way that this process is impacting David's development, you know, really can't be overstated. And try to pick it up with some of those motifs as we begin in the final third, starting with chapter 20 of Shmuel Aleph, as we'll be rounding from summer into fall. So wish everybody a wonderful summer. Hope to see everybody around on a daily basis, but looking forward to resuming it there around Labor Day.